Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Friday night edition. Today's date is the 8th of February, 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me for another most important of broadcasts here. We have great information to be shared today with a returning guest. We have had conversations with this individual, a wonderful researcher. She's written articles. She's done great studies on the plight of the Palestinian people and of the Gaza and West Bank, and it is a really important subject that we don't treat often enough here on the French Connection, because there are so many other things that we're trying to get information out about, but that doesn't excuse the fact that we really need to do more telling this terrible tale of crime and murder and deprivation that has taken place at the hands of the Israelis and the Zionist Jewish interests of Israel, and the world for that matter, because you must include the Western media controlled by Zionist Jewish interests. So it's not just the Israelis doing this; it's Americans that are of Jewish descent as well. Her name is Jennifer Dixon, and we're going to get right into this interview because there's so much for us to cover. I just going to turn it over in the beginning here to her. Jennifer, the last time you were with us, you really went into a lot of detail about the suffering of this population, and it's been in the news, but of course, one of the first things I'd like to start talking about here is how the controlled Zionist media in the world skews the information coming out of Palestine. Could you start with that?
Sure, that's a good place to start, because that's the story. That is
yes,
the
is.
Essential story. Just to lead off, in the first 7 days of this year, of the year 2008, first 7 days of January, 76 Palestinians were killed in the Gaza, and 293 were wounded. And that is reported by Mohammed Elmer, who runs, he's a little Palestinian boy, he's about 22 years old, he's an excellent journalist, he does his work in English. He has hardly, he's left the Gaza once to come to the United States and try to promote himself, but he's right there on the ground reporting it as it happens. And, of course, this didn't get picked up. What
yeah.
we got from the mainstream media was that a woman in that settlement, Sedaro, on the other side of the Gaza, was killed. Now, that would be a tragedy, but we're talking 1 to 76.
Yep.
So, that's just how bad the reporting has gotten. But it's actually always been terrible, because historically Palestinians have died in 6 to 7 times the ratio of Israelis.
And I think it's probably higher than that, Jennifer, to be honest with you, because I don't see any Israelis.
But this is, let me just tell you, it probably is a lot higher, but people have to understand that there is no real journalism possible out of the territories.
Mm.
Occasionally a journalist will go in there like I did, do some work, and then get out. 50 journalists in the first 5 years of this past intifada, which was from 2002 to 2005, were targeted by the Israelis. 50.
Mm.
And
yeah.
14 of them died. So it's not a career with much longevity.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not too good either. But, okay, so you don't get reporting. And you can't get a full story because you don't get constant coverage. And AP there is Israeli controlled, so anything coming out is censored. And the way I got my stuff out is, I won't say, but I got it out. You know, I didn't come through the main airports. But anyway, when I say 6 to 7 times as many have died, I am going back to sources that are mostly Israeli human rights groups, like B'Tselem, which quotes, actually they say 4 to 5 times as many, but they don't, and this is part of the bias built into their own worldview, include in their statistics suicide bombers of the people they call militants. They do include Israeli soldiers that attack the Palestinian towns on the West Bank. So they include soldiers in heavy fatigues and armor, and with sophisticated weaponry, they include as defense fighters, but little boys with rocks and teenagers with rifles are not included because
okay.
they're militants. So that's the craziness of it. And when you include them, you get 6 or 7 times as many people killed on the Palestinian side as
let me ask you this question, see, because what I've discovered is that more often than not, when an Israeli is killed, what they've discovered with the investigating after the fact is that at least half and sometimes two-thirds are actually Israeli Arabs. So what they're doing is they're blaming, they're probably getting rid of these people on their own and then saying that the Palestinians killed them is what I'm guessing.
That is very, very possible. I know.
And then they say it's an Israeli that was killed.
It's Israeli Arabs, or it's third world workers from another country, from the Gulf States or the Philippines or other people that are brought in there to replace the Palestinian workers. Notion of suicide bombers and the way it's been promoted. And I'll tell you why. When I was on the West Bank, I was in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, I was with a Palestinian journalist, and we were traveling, we went over to West Jerusalem, which is the Israeli side. He was frisked in every doorway. Every single doorway. He could not get into a building. So how would you have a Palestinian on the West Bank travel over to Tel Aviv, across the country of Israel, with all that belt and that heavy weight and the bulk that is so apparent, and then walked away into a restaurant, a bus, or whatever, and never be noticed?
Well, this is false flag. This is self-generated false flag terror. And the interesting thing is that they've been willing, in many instances, to kill their own to get the right headline.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that I believe. And as I say, it's suspect. At best, it's suspect. But just to go on to the subject of death and the kind of reporting we're getting, as I said, it's overwhelmingly Palestinian. In this intifada, at least 80 Palestinian children were killed before one single Israeli child lost his life. Now, however, in the American media, this is a very interesting, and I didn't mention this, I think, but it bears repeating. In the American press, the deaths of Israeli children were reported anywhere from 7 to 13 times as much as the deaths of Palestinian children in the year 2004. This was also repeated in 2005, and it had happened in 2003. But anyway, this organization that tracked this specifically zeroed in on the year 2004. In which 176 Palestinian children were killed as opposed to 8 Israeli children. And yet, the coverage was intended to make it appear that there were at least, you know, 1-to-1, if not more,
yeah.
Israeli children were killed. And it's, you know, another part of the spin, and this is something that is just repeated constantly, is how can they target civilians? Israeli soldiers intentionally target children on the West Bank constantly.
Yeah.
Some of the ways in which people die there, I'll just give you some instances. a young man is at home studying. He gets up to stretch, goes to the window, he's shot in the head. A woman sitting on her front porch at the end of the day, gunned down. An infant in its mother's arms, killed by an IDF soldier, shot in its mother's arms. A child at the age of 6, doing her homework in English at desk in the Gaza, shot in the head. So, yeah, I mean, these are not accidents.
No. They're assassinations, and they're... let's get into the idea that this is an actual ethnic cleansing and in every sense a genocide, because clearly the Palestinians don't have the wherewithal to get up and move. If they wanted to, they couldn't leave anyway. We saw evidence of that recently with them not being able to leave the south gate into the Sinai without blowing a hole in it to get across. So the fact is these people are captive prisoners being picked off one at a time, and then, you know, add that up over the years, and it turns into hundreds and thousands, and that, not to mention the murder being committed by starvation, lack of medication, deprivation, mental illness caused by the stress of it all. The fact of the matter is this is an ethnic cleansing and a genocide. Am I correct?
Yeah, you are, and I can give you some other statistics to prove that. You mentioned, the gunning down of children. I want to kind of get back to that. There was a very revealing statistic that 70% of the children shot by the IDF are shot either in the head or in the shoulders. Well, this is targeted. Okay, these guys are sharpshooters, and they know what they're doing. Some other interesting statistics. 25 Palestinian doctors have been killed in the pursuit of their duty. So while they're helping other people who have been gunned down by the IDF, they themselves are being killed. 25 have been killed, and I think it's 425 or 450. That was, these are statistics from the year 2005, so they're dated, so it's gone up. But anyway, 425 had been wounded. There were 991 incidences of the IDF holding up ambulances and detaining them so they could not and take the wounded into the hospitals. There have been multiple situations. Part of the assault on the Palestinians as a people has been, of course, this violence, but there's also the psychological violence and the cruelty that seems to be so now built into Israeli society, with this thing of holding up ambulances with pregnant women in them.
They actually stopped them at the gates to getting into hospital care. And women have died in childbirth right at the border crossing. Am I correct?
They've died in childbirth, and they also hold them up just for the fun of it, and then sit there and have the children giving birth, you know, in the midst of a group of soldiers laughing at them.
Hmm.
So this kind of, it's sadistic. Or I remember one incident that's very just grisly and telling. Well, a young man, it was a cold rainy day in Ramallah or something, in some city up there. It's very cold, actually, rainy in the winter there. And the IDF, for no reason particularly at all, just had him strip in the middle of the street, sit down in the cold rain. He had to bark like a dog until he was told that, you know, that was sufficient.
But now, what is it about the Israelis? Let me ask you this. Let's get into a psychological profile just from evidence that you can put together. What is it about the Israeli IDF and the Israeli public that knows about this? Because I've understood over time that the public is not as well informed about these actions as they should be. So there's a lot of Israelis that are underestimating the cruelty that's being meted out by their military. But I think that that's starting to change. And I think that the Israelis are well aware of what their military is doing. So they're fully complicit. 10 years ago, you might have made the excuse that they didn't know because the IDF was covering it up. But I don't think they're even covering it up anymore. I think they're just wanting a murder of men, women, and children in Palestine, and the public knows it. So give me a psychological profile of these people. Are they psychopaths? Are they sociopaths? Are they a combination? Are they just wanton murderers? I mean, what kind of human beings are doing this?
You know, how can I answer that? I know that it happens. I know that they have to know at this point. I mean, if people in this country and all around the world are beginning to read what goes on, how is it that they're not reading it? And I also have to wonder, since they live kind of cheek to jowl, as it were, that they don't see this. I mean, you can go there and see the condition of the Palestinians. So they have to know it.
But are they being, and my question to you is,
the one thing they are taught, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that is being fed into the Israeli population throughout their lives. And one of them, they've been given this absolutely phony story. But again, how they can believe it, I don't know. But that, you know, that the Arabs came and tried to steal Israel from them, and they were being targeted by terrorists. And, you know, so therefore they've just developed, it's even in the textbooks, this picture of Arabs as almost subhuman. And it's fed into them, so they're raised on hate and fear. And so beyond that, I don't know, because I didn't spend that much time in Israel. I found that when I did, the people were arrogant, very cocksure, I mean, very moneyed. And I just found, you know, the difference between those two societies to be strange in the extreme. I mean, when you're on the Palestinian side, obviously they're depressed. I mean, it's bleak beyond belief. Their lives are horrendous. And so I didn't talk to enough Israelis because I was there to find out about Palestine. So that's, I do not know. But again, I mean, part of the propaganda of being raised Jewish, I think, in any context is that you're a victim. So believe that, you know, and you keep hearing it, you're going to deny the rest of this truth. I mean, one thing I do want to talk about, the control over the West Bank and how that's being taken, how that's being done. I mean, they have told themselves and told the world that this is a fence to provide their security. But what it is, in fact, is a wall that is 700 kilometers long, twice the length, no, is it four times the length of the Berlin Wall, and 25 feet high, which is twice the height. It is made out of concrete. It is thick. Every couple hundred of yards, there's a tower, a gun tower on it, and it snakes its way through the West Bank, and it carves it up into little tiny enclaves that are shooting galleries.
Yeah.
So the Palestinians have nowhere to run and nowhere to hide.
Well, I know what they've done, too. They specifically cut communities in half. Thriving communities have been laid to waste by cutting off their population from their center of town. What they'll do is they'll run one of these walls right through their commercial district and separate the commercial side from the public so that the town dies. In other instances, they've actually cut off road access with these walls so that you can't even get to the community that was once just next door to you.
Right. Well, that's intended. There are 400, this is a couple of years old, but 400 Palestinian farmers are to be separated from their land by the wall. And the wall itself, as you say, what it does is it isolates five cities on the West Bank. They're Qumran, Qalqilya, Hebron, Bethlehem, and Jerusalem. Completely isolates them from the countryside. And when you cut off a town from the country, you cut off the head from the food source, but you also cut off the countryside, as it were, from the administrative head. So effectively, it's one of many measures to destroy the possibility of a so-called Palestinian state, which makes this promotion of it in the media or this impression that's being cultivated that they're really trying to make a Palestinian state. Well, they're not. Because they're obviously destroying it.
Well, they're just buying time. They're buying time, Jennifer, right, while they pick the place apart.
Exactly. There were, in 2005, there were 300 settlements. There were 120 military installations. The wall connects them. So you can imagine this. The settlements are placed on hilltops so that they dominate the landscape and the little Palestinian villages below them. They're also being placed on top of water sources, going back to the subject of water. And they also control the electricity. Now, they will cut off the water for these little villages for days at a time in the summer, 20 and 30 days. They've carved it up, as I say, so that it is a shooting gallery. I mean, there are pictures that I have on my website, Holy Land Unveiled, and you can see this wall. It is not a fence. It is a wall. And these towers, they keep the population in the gun sites.
Well, let me bring up another subject that you've already broached twice with two separate sidebar discussions here. I want to talk about water. And what I know is that the farming communities that grew up around the Palestinian towns and cities before the Israelis were there, water's always been a scarce commodity in that region. And the Palestinians knew that by building cisterns and water catch basins that would you know serve them during the dry period, so they could feed their animals and of course their trees and their small crops for each area. What the Israelis have done is go in with bulldozers and they've filled in all of these cisterns and then they've uprooted the trees the olive trees that have been there for some of them 1,500 years, 1,000 years, 2,000 years even. Some of these olive trees are millennia old. Now, my point being is what they've coveted in that region, and we've discussed this privately, you and I, was that water is an essential ingredient for the continued growth of the Israeli criminal state. And so they need every source they can get, both domestically and internationally. And we'll talk about the international side of it later, but what have they been doing with the groundwater and these cisterns? Have they been pumping them dry, then caving them in? What are they doing?
Well, here's how they've done it. They control, the Israelis control 85% of the water on the West Bank. They pump that into the settlements on the West Bank. And they also transfer the water into Israel proper. The reason this can happen is, if you look at a map, the West Bank is high. Israel is lower. It's on the coast. And because it's high, the water naturally drains down. What they've done is they've not filled in the wells. What they have done is they deep drill beneath the wells, because they have more sophisticated technology, and just suck the water out into Israel proper. Since 1967, I'm reading now, the water resources on the West Bank and in the Gaza are managed by military orders. The Israelis consider water management a quote-unquote security issue. In 1967, under Israeli Military Order Number 58, or the Absentee Property Land Laws, and that's another subject, but anyway, an unknown number of Palestinian wells were confiscated. In 1968, under Military Order Number 92, Israel seized complete authority over all water matters and resources in the occupied territories. This is all illegal under international law. In 1967, under MO-158, Palestinians were prohibited from developing any new water infrastructures without an Israeli-issued permit. Since then, a period of 38 years, permits have only been granted for 23 new wells. This law, too, is illegal under international law. In 67, Israel usurped total control over all surface water from the Jordan River. Since then, Palestinians have been completely barred from using this water source in spite of their having riparian rights under an international treaty. Then in 68, order number 291 declared all water resources to be Israeli government property. This is also illegal under international law. So anyway, you get my gist. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but they have gone in there and controlled the water completely on the West Bank, because when you control water, you control a population.
Well, now let's
I just wanted to, this brings me to another subject, which is farming, mm-hmm. because this is an intended destruction of the Palestinians ever having any possibility of having a viable economy. Palestine is semi-arid, but it is not a desert, and the Palestinians are very brilliant farmers. They, as you said, they've had olive trees, and they were a source for Europe of olives, olive oil, oranges, lemons, figs, pomegranates, wine, grapes. It was their California and Florida. I mean, all the Mediterranean was.
Mm-hmm.
Palestine was part of that. But the land, 28% used to be arable. That's down to 3%, and that's because of this water policy, which is steal the water. In addition to that, the Israelis raise and confiscate land. They'll find any excuse, any military excuse, because it's all militarized, the whole West Bank. So there's no civil law. The people on the West Bank, there's 1,600 military laws they live under, and the people in the Gaza used to live under 1,300. And they controlled every single aspect of life. They could do nothing. So So, and it's all, you know, run through a military court, so it's all emergency law. So
well, let's talk again, though, about water now, and understand that the listening public needs to understand that the Israelis have a habit of using water like a Westerner does. That means, you know, their flush toilets use several gallons each time, and they take long hot showers like the rest of us do in the West. So basically, they live a normal life, but their infrastructure requires far more water resources than they've got available in their own soil.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. They not only have, you know, take hot showers, etc. They have swimming pools. They have green lawns, which is preposterous. I mean, you don't have green lawns in Arizona. So, and I'm talking about a similar kind of climate. So here they are, you know, using the water resources, and meanwhile, the Palestinians do not have adequate water, according to the World Health Organization, do not individually have an adequate amount of water intake a day to maintain their health.
Yeah. Well, now they're trying to steal it from the Bekaa, from the Lebanese. They've got the water table at the Sheba Farms and at the Golan, which is Syrian land that they stole because it was an aquifer that they needed. So basically, one of the main tenets of their policy going forward here is to covet more water from people from other countries in the region. And so basically, they're confiscating Palestinian water, Lebanese water, and Syrian water at hand over fist. And now they've got designs on the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates. Am I correct in saying that?
I believe so. It started as early as 1918. Zionist plans for the borders of their state included the northernmost part of Palestine up to the Litani River, which is the river in the south of Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we've had numerous attacks by the Israelis on the country of Lebanon. This has a lot to do with it. They controlled it after the assault in 1982, and this was another one of these strange false flag operations. Somebody did or didn't get killed on the border or something, or a soldier was captured. As a result, the Israelis launched a military, full-scale military assault and killed 20,000 Palestinians and Lebanese. But they managed to take over the Litani River water sources for the years that they occupied it, which I think was until 1993 or 1996. But they also had tried to do that, so they were rejected then, but they also tried to do it in 1948. The Zionist forces occupied the river up to the land of Lebanon, up to that river, but then they were forced to withdraw. That comes from Israel's sacred terrorism, Bolivia Ropech. So, the water's always been, they've been battling to get it. Now, the worst of the water situation, however, is in the Gaza. I want to read some things just because they're so stunning that you almost have to, you can't believe. In 1947, and this is according to Living on Earth, which is an independent media program, looked into the situation in 1998, that's 10 years ago. At that point, they noted that the Gazans had less water than they had in 1947, when the population there was a tenth of what it is today. The water in 1998 was already so seriously compromised that the interviewer noted that there were tiny worms floating in a glass of water. It was at that point that the people in the camp, the refugee camp there, had barely 5% of the average water consumption in Israel. Raw sewage was floating in the open sewers of the camp, and eventually it finds its way down to the water table. The smell, the mosquitoes, the heat make it unbearable. But more than distasteful, it is toxic. According to a Dr. Abdul Jaber Tibi, he was director of the Public Ministry of Health and the Palestinian Authority at the time of that article, which is 98. The central problem was the presence of aerial disease, particularly dysentery and also anemia. Due to the presence of parasites, they made their way into the intestines of the children. 4 out of 5 children had parasites. 60% suffered from anemia. This Dr. Tibi had traveled all over the world, and he noted that it was the worst data he had seen anywhere. And in addition, from a quote from a doctor in Grosso, an Italian research scientist working at the time in the Gaza, he said that the level of nitrates was so high that the water could be used as a pesticide.
Mm.
However, in comparison, there was an Akiva Backer, and this is an Israeli settler whose who had come from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and moved into the Gaza in the 70s. Now, he remembered once, he was being interviewed at the time, that the Israeli government told the people to wash their cars once a week. Other than that, he remembered no time in the past 25 years, this interview was in 98, where the government asked him to place any restrictions on the Israelis, who had swimming pools, green lawns, etc. And there are people in Gaza who are already living like that.
Well, let's talk a minute about the leadership in the Palestinian territories in Palestine for the on behalf, so-called behalf of the Palestinians. Well, first we've got the Jordanian king, who is he's thoroughly compromised, but this Mahmoud Abbas also, and the predecessors to Mahmoud Abbas in the Fatah movement and the rest. Can you give us a little insight into what these people's bent is and how they're being compromised by Israel, and are they even, in fact, working on behalf of the Palestinians in any way?
Who knows? Well, they certainly aren't doing anything effective. Mahmoud Abbas is so weak as to be completely worthless. That is why the Palestinians voted in Hamas. I mean, under the PLO, under the Fatah, under that rulership, they got nothing. I mean, they were trying over years to make some kind of deal. But there's no real negotiation between the weak and the powerful. I mean, in 98, Arafat said, yeah, fine, we'll take this 22% of the original Palestine, we'll settle. So the response to that, of course, had been, as it has been since 67, for the Israelis to continue to build settlements over there. So what did Mahmoud Abbas say? Oh, well, don't do that, please. Or you're doing too much. Or you know, but it never, I don't know whether he's just a very weak ruler or he's simply, you know, under the threat of assassination, or whether he is actually in cahoots with the Israelis and paid off. You don't know. How do you know? But he of course, got nothing for them. And they knew that, and that this story was not coming out into the main media at all. But it's interesting. What I see even more is, and in studying this history, the last two governments, during that government, Fatah government, the Israelis blew up 415 Palestinian police stations.
Yeah.
Then they accused the Palestinians of not controlling the population. And this is a kind of, I'm trying to think of a polite word, and it's not coming to mind, that they do to the Palestinians just to make their lives impossible so that they cannot govern. At the same time, they were collecting the taxes for the PA, and then they don't turn them over.
Yeah.
So they had no money.
Yeah.
They have no infrastructure. This is something that's not known. 7,000 government buildings of the Palestinians were completely demolished, government buildings, by the IDF between the years 2000 and 2005. They also partially destroyed 63,000, I believe. So every building on the West Bank has bullet holes in it. So you can't have a government like this. And the only people that were keeping them going were the Hamas. Because part of Islamic law is that you take care of the population, and they did. They were feeding them. They were providing clinics. So you have to be in the position of try to put yourself in the place of a Palestinian who has nothing. So you vote for the person who makes your life possible. Now, whether Hamas is compromised, I don't know. Probably. But I also think a lot of them are just, they're young boys. You see these so-called, you know, militants, and I saw the pictures on the walls of the kids, and they're kids who are the crazed militants. They're little boys that have been gunned down. They're little boys with rocks and their first little facial fuzz and rifles. These are the people who are defending Palestine. Some of them are older people, of course, but yeah. So the imbalance is. And again, the impossibility. I mean, look what's being done to this government. The food. This is the EU, the UN, the US, and Israel, of course, all placing sanctions on the government of Hamas and cutting off food, water, any kind of movement of medicines in and out of that border, and trapping the people inside what is a giant prison. And it is a giant prison because they're also building a wall around Gaza. They're even building a wall around the water.
No. Let's ask this question. There are millions of people worldwide who know this story. There are.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that they can continue to do this? Because we know, you know, I know, tens of thousands of others that listen to these broadcasts of this type, you know, it, all told, we're in the tens of thousands now. Why is it that nothing is being done to stop these people from killing these people? They're murderers. They're wholesale murderers.
I guess tens of thousands more need to know. I don't know. I mean, except that they are still in positions of power to influence what's referred to as mainstream society, and that there are not people in positions of power to stop them. So, you know, people in this country, in the United States, I speak of, have really got to sit down and look at their leadership and pull Zionists and Zionist promoters out of positions of power, in the House, in the media, in the universities, which they dominate, in the whole segment of society where they're getting away with this and they're in positions to do it. And they are. And they're still doing it. And yes, people do know. And I think, though, also, they don't hear it enough. Because they get the other thing being thrown at them all the time, and some of this information gets through, and then maybe, I don't know, do people forget? I really don't know. I can't speak
well,
to that for everybody.
You know, there are so many.
Is it just put it out of their heads?
You're right about this overload of information. I mean, these people are committing crimes of every description. There's white slavery they're involved in. They're involved in international drug selling. They're involved in 9/11's murder. So there's so many subjects of crime that these people are doing that to talk about one or all, it's almost overwhelming for anybody to sit down and go through.
Yeah, it is overwhelming in a way. I guess people don't. There's some who put it aside or don't believe it because it hasn't been, you know, you can say, I mean, it's the truth about the human mind that no matter how wrong something is or how stupid it is, if it gets repeated enough, and the other version of this story has been repeated so much that even though it doesn't really make any sense, people still believe it.
Mm,
I mean,
that's true.
They believe that there were no Palestinian Arabs living in Palestine. They were just living in the desert. Well, obviously they were living in the more fertile areas, not the least fertile. I mean, that's common sense. I mean, there are 9 million Palestinians in the world, almost 4 or 5 million refugees. Well, they have to come from somewhere, but they don't come from Idaho.
Now, let's talk about those. Let's talk about those refugees, and most of them are in Jordan, and they've not lived a comfortable life in Jordan, have they?
Well, they haven't because they just, what happened in 48 is 750,000 Palestinians refugees were created overnight.
Yep.
So they had to go somewhere. I can actually talk about, more about the situation in Gaza because a lot of them are in Gaza. There are a lot in Jordan because that was next door. They have become about 50% of the population there, but it's a very small country. Jordan's a tiny country. For instance, Israel has a GDP of $129 billion. Jordan has one of $6 billion. So they're not even comparable societies.
Yeah.
Because it's another phony country. It was just cooked up after World War II. But in the Gaza, there's a population of 1.3 million people. The Gaza comprises 1% of the landmass of the original Palestinian mandate. It is a 12 by 42 kilometer strip of land. And 1.3 million people live there. It is one of the densest places in the world as far as population. 90% of those, no, nearly a million, so I think that's calculated out, 80% of the population are refugees. And they come from Beersheba and Lydda and Jaffa and all the Palestinian cities.
Mm-hmm. Many of them have disappeared. Many of those cities don't even exist anymore. They've been wiped off the map and tried to be wiped off the memory of the world.
Yeah, that's true. 400.
400, yes.
It's interesting. It fascinates me. And I've often been intrigued by the way activists who are pro-Palestinian, presumably, pursue this story. They always talk about Deir Yassin, and that's a horrible story. It is a massacre. The Israelis, the Zionists at that point, blew into this little town, you know, shot it up, gunned down children, gunned down men, slit open the bellies of pregnant women, raped, etc., blew up houses, horrible. But that happened to 400 villages. They were just wiped out. They either were converted into an Israeli place, or they were simply wiped off the map.
Yeah.
And that number's never used. It's rarely discussed in the activist groups, which I find fascinating because it gives a fuller picture of what happened. And as a matter of fact, since I'm talking about destruction, just to get back into more info, the Israelis since 1967 have blown up, demolished 18,000 Palestinian homes. In the last, since 2000, the last eight years, they've blown up 8,000. And when you blow up a home in that part of the world, first of all, the people, it's got twice as many people in it as it can hold anyway, because they lost their first home. I mean, there were refugees created in 1948, and they were created in 1967. So these are houses that hold 10 and 12 people, and 10, 12, and 20 people. So hundreds of thousands have been displaced. But I want to read something that's just about the way Israeli societies think, and the way they go about doing what they do. This is a little bit about home demolitions and the history of it. The military court justifications for home demolitions has an interesting history. In the 1960s, the military could demolish the house of a militant whose actions had caused damage. In the 1970s, they could demolish the house of one whose actions had the intention of causing damage, even if they had not been successful. By the 1980s, the military allowed itself to demolish the house of anyone who had thrown a Molotov cocktail. Then, in 1988, the military decided that it had the right to demolish the house of anyone throwing stones. Then that, too, was amended to include those who had thrown stones, even if they had done no damage. And finally, the law allowed for the demolition of the house of suspected stone throwers.
Ah.
Suspected stone throwers. So, yeah, it's an interesting concept of law. Another one that I find kind of intriguing is some of these murders that the IDF commit. There were, just to get the numbers, the official numbers, these are Israeli numbers. Trying to find it. So, when we have to do this when we come back rather than wasting time with it. But, the poverty of the Palestinians at this point is reaching dire portions.
Well, I think what's happening now is there's a tipping point where actually starvation is setting in wholesale, no medicines being shipped in. There's no water. They got that shut off. The electric's off. If you are required to have some kind of heart machine or some kind of machine, you're going to die.
People
in the West here, we go to a bank machine when we want money. There is no money, first of all, and there are no banks. And these people are living in a Stone Age, almost a Stone Age environment most of the time. And,
they have money, they can get cash, and sometimes the banks work, sometimes they don't. There are some. They're under control. There's not much money. If people are living, this is a World Bank statistic, and it was true as of 2005 that the people in the West Bank were living 50% were living on an income of $3.60 a day or less. That is a family of four. That was 50% of the population. And in the Gaza was 80%. And that precedes all this complete cutoff of the economy, because now they won't have any Palestinians working in Israel at all. And they've destroyed the farming. See, they were turning back into the territories just to do farming, and they've destroyed that. So it becomes worse and worse and worse. And in the Gaza Strip, that strip of land will not support those people, even, providing tomatoes and little vegetable patches. It's just not enough now that they're sealed off. And they are literally sealed off with a wall. And that is what the intention was when they left there. And it's kind of a horrifying story, this story, that came through the media. Again, this is the spin, and it is the way our minds have been manipulated for so long. But there were pictures, of the poor settlers leaving, that is the Israeli settlers. There were 8,000 Israeli settlers in the Gaza Strip, 1.3 million Palestinians. The Israelis were controlling 38% of the land. Again, this is contrary to the agreement they signed at Oslo. They raised most of that on the way out. They pulled out olive trees by the thousand. And they were, however, demanding a payoff of $250,000 a settler, or up to $1 million a family, to leave. They were there illegally. They were demanding $2.2 billion out of the U.S. I'm sure they got it. The poor Palestinians got nothing except sealed into this prison. It's a giant prison.
What are we to do about this? I mean, well, the statistics are sickening. I think we have to declare war on Israel. I think we have to, we have to declare war on that country.
Yeah, but if they do, think what they have as can hold as hostage, the entire Palestinian population.
Well, they're going to kill them all anyway, so why don't we go in with stormtroopers and take the place back? I mean, look, they're going to kill them. What do you want? You want to die fighting, or do you want to die by slow death? Death of a thousand pricks, or do you want to die going out trying to save yourself? Their intention is clear, Jennifer. Their intention is clear. It is to genocide that population.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're going to genocide them. Every single human being living there is going to suffer till they die.
Yeah, or they're going to start. One thing that I was told when I was in Jerusalem, it was by a storekeeper there, they were very afraid of being crushed in a military, like, pincer operation from the Jordan Valley, because Jordan Valley is totally controlled by Israeli military. That's something else people don't know here. So here you've got this population trapped inside these little enclaves, surrounded by this wall. Israeli military in Jordan, Israeli military in the West Bank, 120 military installations inside the West Bank, three huge corridors crossing it that are, I would say, for the movement of military personnel. And they're trapped in these little holes in the walls and have to use the roads designated for them. And their movement is really prohibited. So, but they have this population. They are hostage. And the ones in Gaza, I mean, they were just pouring out of there when they got the chance. Some of them escaped.
Yeah, but see, and here's the interesting thing.
When
the wall was blown up in the Sinai recently, after they got some small amount of supply into the camp, into the Gaza, the Egyptians are in the process now of saying, if you try to break through that wall again, we'll kill you all. Saying that to the Palestinians. What in the world is being told to the Egyptian population to allow their government to make declarations like that?
Well, first of all, there's the Egyptian population, and they're enraged about the way the Palestinians are treated. And then there's the Egyptian government, and that's Mubarak, and he's a thug. And he's paid and controlled, and he has never done anything to those people. And Egypt hasn't since they signed the agreement. And that was the price of getting any kind of money in there. And so this is an interesting statistic that a friend of mine told me recently. He doubted he's a business person. And he wants to help people in Africa. And he knows that all the money, half the money is going into Africa, go into Egypt. Why? Because they signed the agreement. I don't know. I want to read a little quote here from Mr. Rabin's description of the conquest of Lydda. We shall reduce our population to a community of woodcutters and waiters. Here's not a very well-known leader of the Israelis, but this is Yoram Bar-Paras in July of 1972. It is the duty of Israeli leaders to explain to public opinion clearly and courageously a certain number of facts that are forgotten with time. The first of these is that there is no Zionism, colonization, or Jewish state without the eviction of the Arabs and the expropriation of their lands. Or Mr. Menachem Begin. Didn't he win a Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, the Nobel Prize is a joke. I mean, it's completely controlled by Zionists, so it really means nothing. The Nobel Prize is not worth a paper in a bath in a toilet, you know? It's nothing. It's worthless.
Well, this is his peaceful statement. The Palestinians are beast walking on two legs, and that was his remark to a speech to the Knesset in June of 1982. From Rafael Atan, He was chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, and this is a quote from him in the New York Times, 1983. When we have settled the land, all the Arabs will be able to do is to scurry about like drug cockroaches in a bottle. So, I mean, it's, don't say I said so. Yeah, I mean, you can quote them, and they're not, or do they just go back to Theodor Herzl, founder of the World Zionist Organization, who's speaking of the Arabs in Palestine. These were his diaries in 1895, talking about the history, and the, this is not response, in other words. This is what was intended. Spirit the penniless population across the frontiers by denying it employment. But the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly. And I guess what has happened is it's not so discreet anymore. Because other people are talking too, you know, and it is coming through. This is a quote about children, because it's horror that's inflicted on kids there. Children have been shot in other conflicts I have covered. But never before have I watched as soldiers entice children like mice into a trap and murdered them for sport. Christopher Hedges, American journalist in assignment in Gaza.
Well, you know, when Rachel Corrie was unceremoniously murdered by these assassin Israelis, the world did get a taste of their barbary. And even to this day, she covets in my world, on my website, an most honored place, period. The most honorable human being ever, because I watched her courageous act stand before that destruction of that home. But the fact of the matter is, what's being done now there? Are there any heroes left that are telling the story in Palestine?
There's a journalist called Jonathan Cook, and he is on the West Bank. He's trying to get some stuff out. I think he's there. I'm not absolutely certain. I think he's still there.
How about Israelis themselves? Are there any Israelis that are absolutely mortified by the sickness being committed in their name?
A couple of groups I would recommend. Some I very much don't, but some that I would to some degree. Beth Salem, that's a peace group. They do cover, and they are somewhat honest. You know, I'm not sure it's 100% honest, because, you know, you can't be sure. But they will admit to the violation of the rights of the Palestinians, and, you know, they call it the violation of the rights, I mean, death and destruction. But there's also a group called Gush Shalom. And you can get on their websites and see, and they will talk honestly about the so-called generous offer of Barack, and they will be quite clear. It's a very well-done site, and I've taken information from them, actually. The generous offer, you know, when they supposedly offered the West Bank, and, you know, they were giving up Israeli territory, blah, 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 and what they were really doing was setting the situation up of settlements and military installations and chopping up the land into little pieces the size of stamps. But they will be honest about that. Other groups I have a problem with, they're promoting something that's about 2 degrees separation of distance from what the Israeli government supports.
Yeah.
Or they come up with a campaign that, okay, there's a campaign, a new one, because there was always a new one, called Sharing Jerusalem. Well, what Sharing Jerusalem? They've already taken it. I mean, when I was there and I left, I traveled across the country, I left the city of Jerusalem, and on every hill behind it, there was a settlement.
Hmm.
How can they call, you know, and there was also a military installation out there back there. So how is it they're going to share it? And actually, the old city, which is what they covet, because the old city is a tremendous cache of money, of Christian tourism dollars, when I was there, I talked to Arab doorkeepers there, and what one particular man was telling me, I'll never forget. I mean, there was no one in the store, but there was a fast, quick-paced business of buses traveling back and forth between the Jewish quarter and Israel, the rest of the area, and they're bringing all the tourists into that part of the old city. Well, there are four quarters, the Jewish quarter, the Christian quarter, the Armenian quarter, and the Muslim quarter. The Muslim quarter is actually half the city, because that's where Al-Aqsa is. You couldn't get into Al-Aqsa. I got there because I was with Mordecai Vanunu, And he got some permission, you know, got in there. But what they were doing was telling American tourists, when they land to Tel Aviv, do not go to the Arab shops, do not buy anything from them, they're terrorists. Please give us your word, don't go into the shops. So they don't. And of course then they destroy the business of Arab business people in Jerusalem. And they're planting little Israeli settlements, even in the old city. They've got eight police stations, hundreds of surveillance cameras, and settlers all over the place, in the Mount of Olives, surrounding the city, inside the city, St. John's Hospice, everywhere. So they're going to take that over.
What were you treated like by the Israelis themselves while you were there? I mean, were they superficially nice to you because they wanted your tourist money? I mean, I'm talking about people who didn't know why you were there, people who just saw you.
I spent my time on the West Bank. When I was in the stores, or like when I was in West Jerusalem, I was just somebody else. I was just a tourist, you know, buying or whatever. A falafel sandwich and a beer. But, so there was no particular response to me. I was treated quite hostily when I arrived. Quite hostily. And I was surprised that I even got in the country. Because they questioned me, they held me aside, they separated me from the group, they wanted to know I was there, blah, blah, blah.
Because you told them you wanted to go to the West Bank?
Yeah, because I was going to the West Bank. And that was, of course, suspect. And they didn't. And I said I just wanted to go. I said I wanted to see. Well, I mean, the Bethlehem is a well-known location. So is Galilee, so is Nazareth. People have been going there for centuries. So there is a tourist business. There is a pilgrim, there's a business in Christian pilgrim dollars. But it's being controlled by the Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
And they want you to go on their tour buses. They don't want you to buy anything in one of the Arab shops, and nobody goes in them. And it's deserted, that area of the city. I mean, the old city is still it's about 30% Arab. But that also has an interesting story, because another way they get rid of them is they tax them at a higher, they tax them at the same rate, but they only get 30% of the population in the old city is Arab Israeli. They're Arab citizens, they're Israeli citizens, but they only spend 10% of the municipal budget on them. So, I mean, that's another form of discrimination. So everything is old, it's seedy, it's falling apart. Because it's just created poverty to drive them out. It's another aspect of the larger picture.
Well, we've been talking now for over an hour here, and I want you to have an opportunity here to discuss what you really want to get out. Because, I mean, I've been trying to lead this conversation in ways that I thought would be interesting to the listener. But now, mm-hmm. I'd like you maybe to go where you want to go with this. What have you got to say? What prompted you to contact me to try to get this out once again? Because, frankly, I'm a very poorly organized guy, Jennifer. I didn't have your I found your number afterwards, by the way, but I didn't have your number anywhere handy, and that's why I hadn't called you. What is it that sparked your most recent outrage here, and what did you want to really get out?
Okay, sparked it recently is this abuse of the people in Gaza. I wanted to talk about what I have, which is overturning some of the myths. There's so many myths about Israel. One is that they're negotiating the West Bank. I think I've pretty much disproved that. One of them is that they are the main victims of the violence. I think that's pretty much disproven.
Yeah.
Statistically.
Yep.
It's one thing to say, Rachel Corrie was killed, and that's a tragedy. But there are many like that. I mean, there are other activists who've gone there who've gotten killed.
Few of them have been filmed. Few of them have been filmed being run over by a tank, by a tractor.
That got her to center stage, and that was, that one little disaster like that. But my point being is that it also happens off camera.
Yep.
The horror of this is that it's all happening off camera.
Yep.
Tom Herndell, the Brit that was shot down. This is interesting. Again, going back to their so-called legal system, I think I'm remembering these numbers almost exactly, but out of 1,694 murders, cold-blooded murders committed by the IDF in 2005, the Israeli army decided only to investigate 90, and they only handed down 29 indictments. The worst of those, the soldier who suffered the heaviest punishment on that, he received an 8-year sentence in prison.
What kind of crime?
That was for Tom Rendell, and that was because of Western publicity.
Yeah.
So in other words, when they gunned down a Palestinian, they got, you know, a week, they have to go home and wash the dishes. I mean, it's preposterous. The sentences are nothing. So, I mean, of course, if they run it that way, people will do what they can get away with.
I've heard, though, that there's, Israeli military conscripts that are balking at doing this now.
Some that are beginning to have had enough. It's too gruesome. Yeah, that it's just... But, I mean, it still goes on. It's still going on today. I mean, I started this program talking about the number of Palestinian deaths in the first week of January in the Gaza. 76 deaths and 293 wounded. That's over 400 casualties in a week. So somebody's still doing it.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's easier to do because they are creating this infrastructure. I mean, what they're doing with Gaza specifically is they're sealing it off with a wall. As I said, I talked about the water situation there. Well, it's unlivable. And they're cutting off the fuel and the electricity. And they control the airspace, which is one of the reasons they have been able to completely control the Palestinians' ability to govern themselves. I mean, they control the airwaves. That means they hear every phone call, both Muslim.
Yeah.
But every cell phone conversation, etc. So this is how they used to do their targeted killings, which are assassinations.
Yeah.
In those 5 years, they've gunned down 554 Palestinian people, just political people. Israelis always called them militants. But even out of that 554, it was over 280 were just civilians who gathered at the site, who were innocent bystanders. But they gunned them down because they could track them on their cell phone. They could follow the message. Or they would stick bombs in public telephone booths on the West Bank, so you pick up the phone to call. That's it. But in the Gaza, they do it. They target individuals using an Apache helicopter or an F-16. They could track them on the cell phone, blow it up, because even if it's turned off, you can track it. Blow up the car, blow up the individual, blow up the house, blow up the apartment building, and this is how they just mass murder the people. So you can't have organization. I mean, people are sitting here, I mean, I've heard this conversation in the West, that the Palestinians have such bad governance. Well, how can you govern anything when you're targeted like that?
Yeah.
And this is a population that has had insufficient food since...
1967.
Well, yeah, but I mean, seriously, the World Food Program, this was in 1995, and this is a quote from the World Food Program website. WFP has been operating in occupied Palestinian territory since 1995. Its current operation, ending in August 2005, has been feeding 480,000 Palestinians over the past year. The Israelis closed off the fishing. So the fishing dropped to 15% after the so-called withdrawal to what it had been before. So what was this withdrawal? It was an attempt to get the so-called settlers out of there and then just turn on starvation.
Yep.
And this is,
genocide. It's genocide. It's genocide.
It is absolute genocide. And they had already so weakened the population. I just want to read a little something just to give people a flavor of being Palestinian. This is from Anika Hampson. She's writing for Al-Ahram in 2003, and she describes the life of an average young Palestinian man in Gaza. They get up and they gather at 6 o'clock with their lunch of bread and olives in a plastic bag and wait to be allowed to make the walk to the settlement sweatshops. After leaving the relative safety of the wall, the workers, about 200 in all, walk along the sandy road lined with concrete skeletons of half-demolished, bullet-ridden houses and across a bulldozed moon-like landscape of uprooted trees towards the gate and the electronic fence which separates Rafah from Gush Katif settlement. "They're watching us," Ahmed explained. "If there's any indication that something is suspicious, the soldiers will shoot." Now, Khalid works 10 hours a day to support his family, who have been forced to move in with his father after his own house was demolished. Now, 20 people live in the father's three-room house, and Khalid's meager income supports all of them. "We are watched all the time," Khalid says, "and we are not allowed to speak." He has to ask permission to go to the restroom and eats his lunch where he sits. If he is ill, he is not allowed to leave. The checkpoint only opens to allow the workers in and out. Khalid is hired on a daily basis, so work is never guaranteed. Sometimes the checkpoint is closed for weeks, and then we receive no wages. He has no contract, no benefits, no insurance, no sick pay, and he is not officially registered as employed, so he has no severance pay. And these were the people that when the settlers left, they just didn't pay him. They left owing him money. I mean, that's a little insult to injury. But this is just more of the same. I'm getting tired.
Well, Jennifer, this is what I'd like to do.
I want to take a little breather because I do want to talk a little bit more about the Gaza. I want to go into, I'm just trying to not make the statement that it's genocide and not say it's starvation, but show through statistics, through stories, exactly what it has been like leading up to this. And I think it's important. It helps to put this picture into people's minds.
Well, what we're going to have to do here, because this is already a file. This is a file as we speak. I would like you to do this for me. Give your detail information where people can get the information from you, from your site.
Okay. My site is Holy Land Unveiled. That's www.holylandunveiled. HolyLandUnveiled.com. All of it in small letters.
Okay. Here's what I would like to do. I would like to get another installment of this. If you could try to think back on things that we discussed in this particular file, and then try to go through your archive and your information and kind of add value to or broach new subjects in the next file, if you would.
I will do. Yeah, I will do that. I will probably zero in on some stuff I haven't covered.
Now,
there's so much that I can get started and just one thing triggers another thing and just it's unbelievable.
I would like it also if you could maybe pick out a couple of personal stories of Palestinians. Like you just read one of a guy. These humanize the suffering, and so what we need to do is put a human face on the Palestinian, which has been so dreadfully destroyed by the mass media and the control the Israelis have over it. So let's pick out a couple of stories of actual, and read those particular stories because I think that they really touch people in ways that need to be. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. You're right. Both. I'm trying to do both, and I have some good ones.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank you for listening into the French Connection today. Again, my guest has been Jennifer Dixon. She is a researcher, a writer, and has a website on the internet. We will put her information up with this file. We will be doing another installment of this information and some add-on information forthwith. But for now, I would like to tell each and every one of you to take care of your families and please be well. Bye-bye now.
I never made promises lightly. There have been some that I've broken. But I swear in the days still left, we'll walk in fields of gold. We'll walk in fields of gold. As you lie in fields of gold. the sky when we walked in fields of gold. When we walked in fields of gold.